Good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan, president of Prosperity Financial Group, and I'd like to welcome you to another exciting episode of Meet the Expert. We've got an old friend with us today. He's done this a few times with us. Simeon Hyman of ProShares, a $60-plus billion ETF firm based on the East Coast. He is the head of the Investment Strategy Group and global investment strategist for ProShares. I think I got that right, Simeon.
Absolutely.
And we're going to talk about the economy and what's going on here as we're in the first quarter of 2023. And we've had such a crappy year coming out of 2022 for the average investor. People are down 10, 20, 30%. If you've been crazy on the spectrum of technology, you could be down 15, 60%. And if you've been ultra conservative and just sitting in the bond indexes, then you're down 12, double digits still, which is a really bad place to be when you are ultra conservative. So things are changing. Interest rates are going up. Federal Reserve is being really aggressive. Lots of great changes. So Simeon, I'd like to welcome you to our episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And you just wrote a wonderful article that I read about the tale of two economies. I know economists are really torn on this, what's going on right now. Soft, hard landing, growing, expanding, contracting. Are we in a recession? No, we're really not. Is that a technical recession? No, it's not. It's not really because employment is not shrinking. Lots of things happening. So what do you mean by a tale of two economies?
The tale of two economies are pointing out the divergence of the employment economy from the goods and the employment and services economy and the goods and manufacturing economy. And let me give you the two measures that are most easily capture this. You have a very old school measure called capacity utilization. Old guys like me talk about it when we're interviewed. And that is the percentage of the U.S. manufacturing capability that's in use at any given time. Right now, it's a little below 80%. Now, historically, that 80% number has been kind of the inflection point between inflationary and expansionary environments and, let's not call them deflationary, but non-inflationary environments. So in other words, if we are looking at that manufacturing side, it doesn't look overheated. It doesn't look like a big driver of inflation. And I know it's just a little bit below 80, but the range there is small. You know, it's rare for manufacturing that number to be less than 75 or greater than even 82 or 83. So that guy's in kind of a good, comfortable range. Then, of course, we look at unemployment. We see this very low unemployment number, 3-ish and change. And in addition, we see wages, the stickiest part of potential inflation, hanging in there around 5%. So those are the two economies. The goods and manufacturing piece looks kind of tepid, shall we say, but the employment side looks overheated and hot.
All right. So I'm going to do a follow-up question with you if I could on this, but let me remind people how to reach us if we could, because I didn't open with that. It's, if you need to look at our website, it's prosperityfinancialgroup.com. The phone number is 925-314-8503. And the email is Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T, at prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And we're speaking with Simeon Hyman, Chief Global Strategist for ProShares. So we just talked about economies, the two economies going on out there. They're still very based on, and this is my follow-up question to what you just mentioned, and that is the consumer. You know, the majority of global, or let's talk about this U.S. activity, majority of U.S. activity is a consumer-driven market. And the consumer, I keep hearing, depending on whether I'm listening to Fox Business or MSNBC or CNBC, the consumer seems to be, well, December was very good, apparently. We just got that report in. But it was slowing down for the 3 months prior going into that and was meant to be a soft Christmas. We'll find that out. And so forth. If the consumer is slowing down, I don't know if you buy into that, the consumer is slowing down, but if the consumer is slowing down, aren't we slowing down? If the consumer isn't slowing down, then we can't be slowing down. Isn't that true?
I think it's pretty clear that we're slowing down. The question is whether there will be a hard or soft landing. That's what the debate is about. Retail sales have weakened a little bit, but in the most simplest way that I think about it, going back to those two economies, yes, the consumer's slowing a little bit, but we have traditionally seen hard landings driven by the overheating of both the goods and services piece and the both the goods and manufacturing piece and the employment and services piece. And given that only one of those is too hot right now, that suggests a soft landing, because it's when both are overheated that we have a hard landing. So notwithstanding at least a modest decline in consumer spending, consumer strength, I think that prices coming down in that goods and manufacturing side will allow the economy to cool enough without needing a dramatic uptick in unemployment that would really crush the consumer. That's the hard landing. The hard landing is if the Fed has to drive unemployment to 5 or 6% from 3 and change, and that's the end of the consumer right there. But if we're lucky, and I think it's more than luck, let's look at prices. Oil is down. Wheat is down. You know, housing prices are down. Prices are coming down on that side of the equation that should allow inflation to come down enough that you don't have to jack up and hammer unemployment too far and hurt the consumer too much to achieve the Fed's objective.
So are you in the school about inflation? Because we all know that just compared with 2 years ago, maybe not compared to last year, we know what's going on in the egg industry, the meat industry, and so many other areas that are still way jacked up from 2 years ago, maybe not from last year. Are you in the school that we have peaked on inflation? And if we have, are we entering the world of stagflation where we've got rising prices and a slowing economy a la the 1970s?
There are, of course, still pockets of not completely resolved supply chain issues. And of course, we know about the avian flu. I actually bought a car a couple of days ago, and the dealer picked up the phone and started the conversation with, "Have you shopped for eggs lately?" I begged him to stop and just tell me the darn price of the car. Since I do this for a living, I didn't need the prelude to prepare me for the difficult conversation. But when I think about whether inflation has peaked, I don't want to take my thoughts on it. I want to take the market's thoughts on it. And the easiest place to look for that is break even inflation. That is the market telling you. It's the difference between the tips and the regular treasuries. And if I look at break even inflation, you pull it up on any data source right now, what you find is that break even inflation as near as 2 or 3 years from now is at around 2%. So that means that market participants see inflation getting to that Fed target of 2% not too far away from now. It's not 6 months, it's not 12 months, but it's probably within 2 or 3 years. And 5 or 10 years, Ben, it's spot on 2%. So there isn't a sense that we'll have, from the market's point of view, that there will be a prolonged period of elevated inflation.
What about my second part of my question there, Simeon? And that's stagflation, where we have some inflation, but a stagnating economy. Could that be in front of us also?
Well, I think this goes back to the soft landing. And we'll put ourselves in the soft landing camp. I mentioned the key notion of the two economies, since they're not both overheated, that suggests we'll be able to get to a soft landing. I'll give you another reason why the landing will be soft, and we'll include in soft landing the avoidance of stagflation. And another reason to consider the more benign outcome is that the risks are a little lower this time around for the economy. I'll give you my favorite statistic on that. Leverage for the S&P 500 is at all-time lows. Net debt to EBITDA is the classic measure of leverage, and that guy is somewhere around 1 for the S&P 500. Long-term averages are more like 3, even 4. So the risk of kind of real bad stuff, whether it's hard landing, stagflation, seem to be muted at this time.
Okay. Let me switch gears with you, if I could, Simeon. And let's talk about the Federal Reserve. That has been exceptionally dovish for 5 years, and now getting hawkish, a little less than it used to be, but still fairly hawkish, and not willing to commit to stopping interest rates from being raising the interest rates up. What's your feeling about that?
if we're looking at the curve, that the Treasury curve, the market's assumption is that those Fed rates peak out somewhere in the next 6 to 12 months. So, you know, as the old saying goes, this might not be the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. We're in sight of peak Fed. But here's what's important to take to put in context here. Now that we're done with both quantitative easing and quantitative tightening is well on its way, the Fed is stepping back from trying to control longer-term interest rates. So those longer-term interest rates, the 5-year, the 10-year, the 30-year, at this point are likely to be more range-bound. So right now we've got a 10-year Treasury at about 3.5%. We already discussed break-even inflation is 2. If break-even inflation is 2, the real return on the 10-year historically has been on average another 2. And so using math from somewhere around kindergarten, 2 plus 2 is 4. And if we're at 3.5, okay, let's call it range bound between 3.5 and 4.5. It's not an exact science, but that's going to be true likely even as the Fed hikes a few more times and even as they bring down the overnight lending rate, because the ultimate equilibrium is if 2% inflation we get there, then we should have a 2% Fed funds and a 4% 10-year. So we're going to see this Fed funds go up a little bit more and ultimately probably come back to 2. And it may take a couple of years for that to get that all the way back down. But in these next 6, 12, 18 months, I'm going to suggest you see reasonable stability when you look at longer term interest rates, 5 and 10 years. So don't expect those longer term rates. You may not have as much downside exposure for rates that price down as the Fed keeps hiking, but don't also expect upside when the Fed starts to bring them back down sometime towards the end of this year.
Okay. Why isn't this a recession when you've got two negative quarters of growth, which we had? Why is this different from all others?
Yeah, I'm not the NBER expert, so I can't even remember exactly why two slightly negative years aren't officially a recession. But when we point to soft landing, it's probably a mild recession, a mild decline in nominal GDP. Whether that officially rings the bell for the NBER, I can't remember what the extra little rules are. But it does look to be relatively benign, but probably a little bit of a decline in nominal GDP.
Okay, so let me ask you about a couple sectors of the economy that did do well when everything else was falling apart. We know the technology, and I want to ask you about that, the technology sector, the semiconductor sector. Those are the worst performing sectors last year. The best performing was basically energy. Do we have any reason to believe that that's going to change over the next 6 months?
The challenge here is that I think folks got the narrative a little bit wrong. And what I mean by that is that there was almost too much of a emphasis on the quote unquote duration of stocks. Now, part for aside the fact that you know, energy prices went through the roof. That, of course, was driving energy prices. And I think that tailwind is substantially mitigated at this point. But you know, let's think about that technology story and the growth story overall. I think there was a little bit of a tendency to overplay the bond analogy to stocks. And what do I mean by that? In the bond market, you mentioned in your opening comments that people lost money in bonds because yield up, price down. And if you believed last year that yields were going to go up, what did you do? You bought shorter duration bonds. You shortened the duration, you shortened the maturities of your bonds so that they would have less exposure to those yields that rose a lot. I know they've been rallying a little bit, but remember, we went from a 10-year at 1.5. Yes, we peaked almost at 150, but we're still 200 basis points higher. And people said, well, okay, if I was going to reduce the duration of my bonds, shouldn't I also reduce the duration of my stocks? And that, I think, is an overreach, because what would that mean? That would mean you'd have to buy stocks that aren't growing. You'd have to buy dirt cheap stocks that aren't growing. And if you do that, what are you left with? What is a stock that doesn't grow its earnings? Well, heck, that looks like a lot like a bond with a fixed coupon. And isn't that the worst thing to own? I mean, we tell all our clients that the salvation of equities is growth that delivers real return over in excess of inflation over long periods of time. So I think that there's a temptation to look at last year and say, man, I don't want stocks to grow. You need stocks to grow. The challenge is to find prudent growth. For us, the one of the key answers is to focus on dividend growth. A lot of people are familiar with the S&P 500 dividend aristocrats. They're the companies in the S&P 500 that grew their dividends for 25 straight years. Our ETF is ticker NOBL. Last year, it outperformed by 12%, driven by what? Delivering fundamentals in a challenging market. They expanded their margins when margins contracted for the S&P 500. But then the other leg is the dividends compound very nicely over time, allowing you to participate. So to put a period at the end of the sentence and bring it all the way back to technology, there's also, we have an ETF TDV, and that's the Technology Dividend Aristocrats. And these are consistent tech dividend growers. Now, here's what's interesting. Last year, the tech dividend growers, TDV, outperformed the tech sector by 12%. You say, great, I knew it was a defensive strategy. Through yesterday, year to date, we have this little nascent technology rally. Tech is up 7.7%. TDV is up 7.6%. Close enough. It's a participate and protect approach. So I think you can't throw growth out the window because that's the only way you get real returns, but you've got to find prudent growth, and dividend growth is certainly one avenue to do so.
Okay. Let me stick with you for a moment on growth. And I do want to separate out, because you've been great. We've been speaking with Simeon Hyman, who is a global investment strategist, chief global investment strategist, basically for ProShares, a $60 billion ETF company out on the East Coast. And I'm at 925-314-8503 or Elliot@prosperityfinancialgroup.com. Let's break down equity and fixed income for one moment and how people can invest and how they should look at it. But let me ask you first, go out on the right side of risk right now, not political risk, but on the risk. And that's talking about Bitcoin for one second, because it was only a short time ago that Bitcoin was at 60,000 and then it was retracted to $17,000. And there's still lots of people that don't understand Bitcoin, Ethereum, and blockchain. It's very confusing for many people out there. So how do they get into the world of Bitcoin in some small way of doing it without killing their exposure at the same time?
Sure. Over a year ago, we launched a ticker BITO, BITO. That's our ProShares Bitcoin Strategy ETF. And the approach that we took was one that I like to call belt and suspenders. The exposure to Bitcoin is through Bitcoin futures. And of course, it's in an ETF governed by the 1940 Security Act. Why is that so important? Because what we've found and what has come to be very evident over the last few months is it is challenging to get Bitcoin exposure. Getting exposure to Bitcoin through simply opening an account at a Bitcoin exchange can be an issue. It is an immature market. Forget fraud and malfeasance. In the second quarter of this year, the largest U.S. Bitcoin exchange raised their hand and said, hey, if we go bankrupt, your Bitcoin exchange account, your little Bitcoin brokerage account could be commingled in the bankruptcy. You would never expect that as a stock investor because that doesn't happen with your stocks. They're, of course, segregated in the event of a bankruptcy. By using the futures in an ETF, the futures market is a regulated place and it's got a clearinghouse and counterparty risk is managed and it's regulated. And when you put that into an ETF, where, of course, by definition, the assets are segregated, you have a belt and suspenders approach to exposure to Bitcoin. It's going to remain, obviously, but in all likelihood, a volatile investment. The blockchain is in its early development and is likely here to stay. So it's an opportunity for folks to prudently be able to get exposure into a mature piece of the Bitcoin market. That futures market has been performing real well. BITO and Bitcoin futures track the price of spot Bitcoin very well. So it offers an opportunity for folks to prudently have exposure to Bitcoin in their portfolios.
Great. So let's break down what I brought up a few minutes ago, Simeon, and that is making money in this economy now in fixed income and making money in the world of equities, because clients are sick and tired of what happened to them in 2022. Nobody likes losing money. Nobody does. Doesn't matter whether you're low risk or high risk. You might be more tolerant of the risk, but it doesn't mean you enjoy the experience. Just because I like riding roller coasters doesn't mean I like somebody throwing up in front of me on a roller coaster. So let's talk about first fixed income. How do these conservative investors today make money?
On the fixed income side, you have what everybody's been talking about. You have this inverted yield curve. We talked about the Federal Reserve likely hiking for a little while longer. So what this means is there's still a small window of another 12, 18 months, maybe 24 months to get some pretty darn good yields from shorter duration treasuries, which is not quite a cake and eat it too. You have reinvestment risk, but you're probably going to be okay on the reinvestment side for the reasons I mentioned before, that there's likely to be stability in longer term interest rates. So I think on fixed income, if you're looking at at the treasury side of the equation, why not take one more time the advantage of the Fed hiking and invest in kind of 12 to 24 month paper? But I also mentioned the low leverage of the S&P 500 as delivering an opportunity in corporate credit. So one can certainly have in this environment exposure to investment grade bonds. Here's an interesting way to do it, though. If you look at, we meant the yield curve, and I'm going to do things with my hands. So, but we actually have some research on our website. You can pull up some pictures that won't make you have this vision of my hands. The treasury curve is inverted. The corporate bond curve is not. So longer term investment grade bonds, as an example, their yields go up the longer their maturity is. That means the spread over treasuries for a longer duration corporate bond is much bigger than a short duration one. But we just said the treasury curve was inverted. Now, follow the bouncing ball on this, but pick up the phone and call Elliot because you're going to need to have this explained one more time for about 5 minutes. You can buy longer duration investment grade corporate bonds. You can hedge out the interest rate risk just in case we're wrong and the 10-year goes from 3.5 to 5. But the hedge in normal terms times would cost you money. The hedge is actually going to make you money this time around. Make yourself a little mental note, follow up, because it will take another 3 to 5 minutes for everybody to completely get that. But just park that in your mind. Hedging the interest rate risk out of an investment grade corporate bond actually makes you money and protects you from rising rates at the same time. On the equity side, the important thing to note is that it's likely to be all about earnings. Multiples already contracted. We're trading at 18 times. That's very consistent with 3.5-4% 10-year yields on treasuries. The expectation going forward is only for very low single digit earnings growth. So that's not a terrible bar. By the way, expectations for the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats Nobles Index are actually lower than the broad market. We can't figure that out. I mean, they're the guys that showed up with like 4 times the earnings growth last year and are expanding margins even so far in the Q4 earnings season, but that's a little footnote. So multiples likely to stay stable. A low bar for earnings growth, it's not a terrible entry point. But the thing that I would add is make sure that the equity side is diversified. You were rewarded for the last, particularly with regards to market capitalization. You were rewarded for the last decade by ignoring mid and small cap stocks and just having large and mega cap stocks. You will likely be rewarded going forward by making sure you have some exposure to those mid and small cap stocks. They were trading at the same valuation as large caps 10 years ago. They're now trading at 50 cents on the dollar. Don't ignore the full spectrum of equity opportunities that are available to you in your investment portfolio.
Great. What do you think? Writing myself a note here as we're talking. Is the energy play dead? Is it over?
I don't think it's dead, it does not appear that the same dramatic increase in price is going to happen. You do have most of the margins are pretty decent at these level of prices. So this is not the recipe. Yeah. Energy as a sector went from double digits in the S&P 500 down to 2% 2 or 3 years ago. It's now up to 5. You know, that kind of secular decline seems to not be in the cards. And also remember that it's not the top of mind thing that drove energy performance last year. But keep in mind, a lot of people are talking about the green revolution. Whenever I hear the words revolution, disruption, transformation, my head immediately goes and asks the following question: who's going to win? Are the incumbents going to win, or the new guys going to win? Because that's a lot of people will talk about disruption and transformation, but don't always assume that means that incumbents are in trouble. There's a pretty darn good chance that a lot of the legacy energy companies will be decent participants in whatever this green thing becomes. So that's another reason not to say, man, well, the run in oil prices is over, I got to stay away from this. Not necessarily, because over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's not like all those companies are going to disappear and they're going to be 10 new green ones that are going to be in the S&P 500. Most of those guys are going to participate one way or the other.
Okay. And then just the last question about the equity income and where the market's going, and that's semiconductors and, you know, the worst performing sectors in the country last year, but the darlings and growth engine of the United States at the same time. And it's kind of the tail of left arm and right arm there.
You know, there's still not precisely my area of expertise, except I just experienced on Friday. I got my new car. They only gave me one key. And there's a sticker on the window that says, we'll get you another key one of these days. So the semiconductor thing ain't over yet. It's really far from my area of expertise, but it is a continuing repairing part of supply chains. I'll broaden out your point just a little bit, because some of this does come down to China and the reopening. The wild card for inflation to some extent is, if it's a really great reopening in China, that can have some reflationary aspects to semiconductors, energy prices, and a whole host of things. So I think keeping an eye on that reopening will be important, because not all supply chains have totally resolved yet. And if they really crank up the economy, that could put a little boost behind energy and commodity prices as well.
Well, we've been talking with Simeon Hyman of ProShares. It's been a great conversation. Hopefully we haven't confused our audience.
Only on the interest rate hedge bond idea. That's the only one that I guarantee you're going to get a phone call. What did he say?
it's a hard concept, but the key is for investors that, look, what worked during COVID and before obviously did not work last year at all. And what's working right now are good quality companies. Simeon mentioned you need to go from just mega caps like Apple and Amazon's on down to smaller mid-sized companies with good cash flow that pay dividends, that are quality. And I think the one word, and I know Simeon would have loved to have said, is quality is key when it comes to looking at good investments. You need quality in your portfolio, because some of these companies, particularly in technology, they have revenue and no net income, and they're not going to survive. They're going to be taken over by somebody, because that's what it changes. Am I correct on that?
Yes, and I think I said quality, because if I don't say quality at least once, it's going to show up in my review. But thank you for reiterating it. It's really, really important. Can't emphasize it enough.
And you did mention Noble, so we're going to give you almost said the right word, but you just said Noble first, which is great. It's great of Noble. What is the difference between Noble and Regal?
Noble is the S&P 500 dividend aristocrat, so that's large caps. These are the companies that have increased their dividend for 25 straight years out of the S&P 500. It was 64 companies. We had actually three entered in the January reconstitution, and so it's 67 now. And Regal is the mid-cap 400 dividend aristocrat. So I mentioned the importance of thinking about mid-caps in your portfolio. Considering mid-cap dividend growth, REGL, the S&P 400 dividend aristocrats, can be a really great choice. Because the one challenge in going down in market cap from large to mid and even to small cap, and we have SMDV, which is our small cap dividend grower, typically, if you just do this off the shelf, quality declines with market capitalization. And that increases risk, and particularly if we do have even a mild recession, puts those lower quality small companies at risk. But by focusing on dividend growers in mid and small cap, you can have a little bit of your cake and eat it too, because you're getting the exposure to the undervalued smaller companies, but you're cranking up the quality such that you're mitigating some of the risks that could come along with that.
And I know there are companies that use those indexes and even overlay options writing on top of them, which is really going to confuse our clients, but they're doing it and you're not. The individual client isn't experiencing the options, but the companies is raking extra income from the option. Is that a good strategy?
So we leave that to you, because we do have, you know, we have plenty of clients and their advisors who will take an OBL and deploy an option writing strategy on them on Noble to generate additional income. It certainly can be a strategy that can add income to your portfolio. And, you know, particularly now that volatility is a little higher. When volatility is really, really low, I would suggest that you just don't make enough money almost to be worth writing those options. And that was true for many years. We had volatility down in the 10 and 12 standard deviation range, very, very low. But now you're in the high teens, you make some money off of it. By all means, we see lots of folks writing those options on NOBL to generate some extra income, for sure.
Great. Well, Simeon, I want to thank you so much. This has been Meet the Expert with Simeon Hyman from ProShares. Been a great economic conversation. And come to our website and you can look at another 40 different episodes, including a few with Simeon at www.prosperityfinancialgroup.com. And I look forward to seeing you again. Simeon, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Have a great day, everybody.